Welcome to the Berean class. We're studying the subject of Christian ethics. Several years ago, I had the privilege of being part of a small group of people that were invited to visit the Disney World Skunk Works at the Disney Institute, where you had a chance to hear what the executives of Disney do in terms of the whole philosophy of Disney World and how it operates, what their future is all about, so forth and so on. And there are a number of things, a number of lessons that I'll never forget from the things that we heard. But one of them that struck me basically is captured in a quote by Roy Disney, the nephew of Walt Disney, where he says, it's not hard to make decisions when you know what your values are. And I think most people do not realize that Disney World, that Walt Disney, was on a crusade. He was on a mission. He had a vision not just to entertain people or to make money. Those were not the big deals. He wanted to change the world by inspiring creativity in children. And the things that he did were aimed principally in that direction, for that purpose. And that still is the part of the core vision of Disney Industries. The same is true with respect to the whole matter of Christian ethics. A lot of what makes ethics a question now that is a big question mark is values are all over the place. And if you don't have values, ethics basically don't make sense. Ethics are tied to values. And one of the contributions that Christians can make to the discussion on ethics generally comes from the fact that Christians come with, or at least most Christians should come with, a set of clear values. And we're talking about values with respect to shaping ethics in this class. We're not starting by looking at specific issues like abortion or sexual behavior or economic issues. We'll talk about those as we go along. But principally, I'm interested in helping us look at the skunk works of Christian ethics. What are the principles behind what's really going on the streets with respect to making ethical decisions? And this morning we're going to be looking at the relationship between church and state. We started that last week. And specifically, what it means to promote the general welfare. America has made two great contributions to human government, in my perspective. You may disagree with me. These are two things that I think the American idea has contributed to the world of government. One is this: respect for and separation of both church and state. In many cases, government and or church and state have been united. In America, they are respected as separate, distinct units, but both are seen as having an important role. Secondly, respect for the sanctity of both the individual and community. America, for most of us who have lived in America, take this for granted. But in many parts of the world, and for those of you who have grown up in another part of the world, a different culture, you're more keenly aware of the fact that in America, our attention given to the dignity of the individual, be they productive or not productive, be they be wise or not wise, gifted or not gifted, the individual, human rights, very, very important. And that is, unfortunately, a unique contribution to government and to history. Both of these are summarized in our national motto, E Pluribus Unum, in plurality, unity, or in diversity, unity. That is a motto that captures a lot of the essence of what makes America's spirit what it is. Robert Casey, Senator of Pennsylvania, puts it this way: our moral, religious, and political traditions are united in the respect for the dignity of human life. And not that that's not just the preservation of bodies, but the dignity of human life, the quality with which people are treated and respected. Richard Nixon made this statement, that coming from Richard Nixon is probably particularly important. Scrubbing floors and emptying bedpans has as much dignity as the presidency. And that's something very few heads of state would ever be saying. In America, you can say that. Now, we don't often treat people that way, but that is part of the idea of what it means to be America. When we look at the teaching of Jesus, his teaching with respect to the relationship between government and God, church and state, is summarized in the minds of many people, and I think appropriately, with this phrase from Matthew chapter 22. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God. The relationship between God and government is something that Jesus didn't ignore, nor did the apostles. And the respect for the separation of both God and government was respected and seen by both. Our disposition with respect to these two great authorities in life is at the heart of wise ethical decisions. How we relate to God, how we relate to government, will tell us and guide us in significant ways in terms of how we make decisions ethically. Our view of these two great authorities over all of life. The United States of America, I think, is often misunderstood in terms of what the idea is all about. And I'm going to spend a few minutes here in just a brief civics lesson. And I don't want to be too simplistic here, but I want to make the point that the American idea and spirit comes to us with some uniquenesses that many Christians don't appreciate or understand. Is America a secular state or a Christian nation? That's a debate that has gone on and still is going on in many circles. And I'm going to suggest that G.K. Chesterton was correct when he said, it's a secular state with the soul of a church. And by that he meant, it is not a Christian nation per se, but it does have respect for a sacred canopy. And there is a sense in which the Judeo-Christian ethic, the Judeo-Christian worldview, has played a huge role and does play a huge role in the formation of its institutions and the functioning of those institutions. There are three pillars to American political culture, as I see it. One is the European Enlightenment. The second, the European Enlightenment, basically was this notion that mankind is enlightened when he steps away from and out from under the authoritarian traditions of the church or of an imperial state. The attention is given to the individual and his conscience or her conscience. And there's a sense in which common sense or nature and nature's rule or natural law is to guide us. The second pillar is what I would call a Greco-Roman government, or a model of governance that comes from Greece and Roman, from classic culture. Republican democracy. A democracy where people who are citizens have a say in the government, but really the government is run by elected wise people. We elect people who we trust are going to rule us or govern us or manage us. And thirdly, a Judeo-Christian moral value system. Represented primarily in early America by the Puritans, the Protestant Puritans, and their influence on our culture. And that's a worldview that basically has a beginning, a creator, and an ending, a judge. And the God that does this is a generic God. He's not necessarily the Christian God or the God of an Eastern religion or of Allah, but he is nonetheless one that is, in a generic sense, what Thomas Jefferson called it, a general God or a general religion. The three pillars have this in common. Each of them basically underscore the dignity of the individual. Freedom for all people coming from the Enlightenment, justice for all persons coming from the system of government, and the dignity of every soul coming from the Judeo-Christian tradition. They share this in common. The human soul is of great value, and the conscience of the individual is to be respected and honored, no matter how productive they are, no matter what their skin color is, no matter what their endowment is in terms of the benefits of providence. Underlying all of this was the assumption that there is a transcendent authority. The Founding Fathers called this nature and nature's God, or natural law. And this was a generic God, but that generic God was respected or reflected in all major religions and philosophies. This is why, for example, when you go to Washington, D.C., and you see on the edifices of the prophets of the great buildings that adorn our capital and its grounds, references to Moses, but not just to Moses. We have references to all the great religious leaders and lawgivers, those basically who contributed to civility and transcendent authority in society. This was the notion of most of the followers, most of the founders of this country, that nature and nature's God really was the foundation for which the Enlightenment, the classic forms of government, and even the Judeo-Christian tradition arise. It's from that foundation, in those pillars, that the social contracts, our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution, basically have their origin and are to be understood. Now, the debate goes on in our country as to basically which of these is legitimately the founding source of America. If you are a political conservative, you probably are going to draw attention to the nature and nature's God part, the transcendent canopy, so to speak. If you are a part of the religious right, you're going to narrow that down to the Judeo-Christian contribution through Puritan Protestantism, or what some have described as progressive patriotic Protestantism, American religion, civil religion. And if you're a more political liberal, you're going to emphasize the Enlightenment and the systems of government and say, basically, that's all you need to know. Forget about what goes before. That's a part of a different generation we're living now with, is a governmental system and the ideas of the Enlightenment, and we need to go back. It should go back no further than that. So a lot of the debate publicly is not expressed this way, but these are the battlegrounds invite the controversies and fights. Dwight Eisenhower underscores the fact that nature and nature's God, or a generic God, really is an important part of the American idea, with these words: basic to our democratic civilization are the principles and convictions that have bound us together as a nation. Among these are personal liberty, human rights, and the dignity of man. All these have their roots in a deeply held religious faith, in a belief in God. But we are very careful to note he is not describing this as the Christian God. John Adams, much earlier, had this to say in making a treaty with a Muslim country: the government of the United States is not in any sense founded upon Christian religion. And he was right. It was not founded upon a Christian religion, or the Christian religion, but upon a generic religion, a general theology. And that's something that I think many of us miss. And when we miss that, we, as Christians, do not know how to make a contribution legitimately to our culture. And part of what goes into understanding ethics in terms of church and state, God and government, is understanding where we have a voice and how to exercise that voice. We the people of the United States, according to the preamble to our Constitution, starts with these words: we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves, our prosperity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. Two things I want us to notice here. We the people, it's not God, it's not the church, it's not the king, it's we the people. We the People is an experiment in government of, by, and for the people, not just the state, the king, or the church. And that is significant. That's what makes America unique. Rendering to Caesar means involvement in government. When we speak of the government as them or they, we are not acting like Americans. The American spirit means that we do not step away from the fact that we are the government. Now, the fact is, government has become an industry unto itself in the minds of many people, where we don't feel a part of the government. We feel as though civil servants are neither civil nor servants, except for their own careers, politically. Politics becomes a career as opposed to a service that we render. In the minds of the fathers, serving politically was like serving on jury. You're called up as a citizen, and you're barely paid to do your civic duty. It's no longer that way. Now, politics is a very lucrative business, and people find it very attractive to get involved in that business because of the power and the profits that are gained through it. But then it becomes very difficult to be a civil servant. The promotion of the general welfare is the door to and the limits of legislating ethical behavior. When people say you can't legislate ethics, they are right and they are wrong. We can't legislate, and we shouldn't legislate specific ethical behavior in many cases. But you can't avoid in any legislation reflecting a worldview and an ethic, a set of values. Values are going to be expressed in terms of our laws. And those laws are constantly being formed, reshaped, refined, discarded, and so forth and so on. And Christians as citizens have a voice in terms of the benefit of the general welfare toward the establishment of justice and freedom. The penalty for good the penalty good men pay for indifference to public affairs is to be ruled by evil men. That, of course, that was not it was first said by Plato, I think, but it's been reiterated by many other people since, and it certainly is true. We don't have a right to complain if we're not involved as citizens of this country. Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 7 has these words, which I think capture a lot of the emphasis of the teaching of both the Old and New Testament, especially the New Testament. Seek that is speaking here to the Israelis who were held captive by another nation. Seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you will have welfare. And there the interest seems to be in God protecting his people by saying, learn to be a servant to your boss. Because when you're a servant to your boss will treat you well. Now, that goes against the grain of a lot of what our natural instincts are as Americans. We don't like the idea of being under any boss, even God. As a matter of fact, we tend to have a tendency to make God in our image. God basically votes the way we do, certainly. And God basically has the same lifestyle we have. We basically get him to be a chaplain for our personal lifestyle and agenda. That is terribly American in the wrong sense. But it's also something we unfortunately take for granted. We assume that he looks like us. I know in the Lutheran church where I grew up, we had a picture of Jesus in the Sunday school hall where, as children, we went to Sunday school every week. And he was very Scandinavian looking. He was blonde, had Nordic features. I mean, you've seen that picture of Jesus. He looked just like our ancestors. And when I was basically being ministered to by Campus Crusade for Christ on the university campus, the Jesus there looked like a campus revolutionary. I mean, he was an all-American cowboy, John Wayne type guy, who basically was going to change the world. I mean, just like you'd expect a cultural crusader to look. And if you look at the Jesus of the Middle Ages, he looked basically like the icons that represented the ideal of those who were in the governing class that were not they were not quite human. The U.S. government is designed to salute the dignity of each person. And if we want to understand something of what makes America unique and what is at the essence, at the very core of the ethical mainstream in the American vision, it is this dignity of the individual. No matter what your skin color, no matter how bright you are, and this is going to be most important because I'm going to get to this in the next couple of weeks, no matter how much money you make. Because in our world, the way in which you keep score is by your income or your net worth. People with a high net worth who make a lot of money are seen as being successful, responsible, and good citizens. Those who are unemployed, who have very little money or make minimal contributions to the making of something, or goods or services, are seen as being marginal. Now, we as Christians, unfortunately, occupy a lot of that way of thinking. And I think that when I read the New Testament, I have to admit, I just find that that doesn't smell right. There's something about the New Testament that just, you know, blows that odor away. And yet that odor is so strong, it tends to stay with us. Most of us who grew up in America have a strong propensity to respect the idea of free enterprise capitalism in terms of its distribution of goods and services. I'm going to suggest, and I'm going to make some enemies here, I'm going to suggest, although I'm not a socialist, that when you read the New Testament, there is a big challenge to that. There's a big challenge. There's nothing wrong with making money, but the way in which we view money, the way in which we allow money to grade us in terms of our worth, that is something that is foreign and even hostile to the kingdom of God. And as Christians, this should be one way in which we, in rendering to Caesar, make a contribution. The way in which we view stuff. The way in which we view the way in which the world keeps score in terms of a person's value. The right to life, liberty, and the free choice in pursuing and securing happiness through virtue. The idea of happiness in the mind of the fathers of this country was not hedonism. The understanding of happiness was grounded in a sense of virtue, of being responsible. Now, the understanding was that would bring real happiness, real joy. It wasn't just a matter of entertaining yourself with stuff. It was a matter of making a contribution and feeling good about what you were doing. It seeks to maximize personal freedom in most matters by not getting involved. In other words, the whole notion of trusting the individual, the individual's conscience, is reflected in government's restraint in telling people what to do. Or at least that's the way the founders saw it working. Christian citizens render to Caesar when they promote and preserve the dignity of each person through empathetic, respectful caring. And that, I'm going to suggest, is really at the heart of what it means for us to render to Caesar as Christians. To the extent that we respect the dignity of God's image of every person, even people who have hurt us, or people who aren't contributing much to society as society measures contribution. The way in which we treat the little people among us, the people who are minorities in any category, has a lot to do with our ethical responsibility. And that includes, for example, that's why abortion is a big question. The unborn, do they have civil rights? This is why race is a big issue. It should be for Christians. This is why poverty is a big issue. Because in our country, poverty and power go together. And I think the church needs to be in a situation where, as Christians, we need to be in a situation where our thinking about the value of people is not measured in terms of their wealth, their skin color, their intelligence, or their blue blood status or lack thereof. That should mark the core of our ethical thinking as citizens. Christian ethics starts with the disposition of the heart toward peace with both God and man. It's like 1 Timothy chapter 2. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions, and thanksgivings, be made on behalf of all men. All men. Nero was king when this was written. For kings and all who are in authority, so that you may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. This is good and acceptable in the sight of God our Savior. Paul writes to Timothy, and he says, I want you to be in prayer for everyone. And I want you to be thankful for everyone around you. Not just your brothers and sisters. Not just people who are productive, those who are virtuous and good. I want you to be thankful for everyone. I want you to see, he's not putting it this way. I would add this by way of commentary. I want you to see people the way God sees them, in terms of being image bearers. Be careful when you curse someone. Be careful when you ignore someone. Be careful when you despitefully use someone or treat someone as worthless. And this starts with your heart. Out of your mouth will come the disposition of your heart. And the point here is, Paul is saying to Timothy, start with the inside of your life, your prayer life, what you pray for, what you pray about. Let your heart be seen before God, and then in your words before men, and your actions as well. Christians are not called to conquer or curse others in the name of Jesus, but to cherish and care for them. Now, I'm not saying that there isn't an important role for the Christian community to critique a lot of what goes on in our society. But so often, our critique comes in terms of either conquering or cursing, as opposed to cherishing and caring for. This is why, for example, I have no qualms about being critical of what's taking place in Washington, D.C. or Hollywood, California. I mean, both coasts have their problems. You've got to move to the Midwest to really get sanity. Because that's where I grew up. I'm just kidding, of course. We're all in need of critique. But when we critique what comes out of Hollywood and out of Washington, we've got to recognize that there are elements there of the image of God that we don't want to miss. In Hollywood, there is this sense of justice, misguided perhaps, a sense of a desire of human hearts for justice and for pleasure and for peace. Misguided in terms of where it's going to be found, but at least there's that passion. For many Christians, unfortunately, that passion has been killed out by concern over doctrines of some sort, or over church practices. Would that we had the same passion for justice and peace that many people in Hollywood have. They display the image of God. The same is true in Washington, D.C. I think there's a lot of things that come out of Washington are frustrating for Americans right now. The ratings of our Congress are lowest in history. But I think we've got to recognize that these people bear the image of God. And in many cases, their motivation is good at parts. Of course, we see all the things that we don't like. But there's a sense in which if we're going to criticize them, we've got to basically own part of that. We are responsible as citizens in terms of what we see. At the heart of ethical civil service is the preservation of personal dignity and rights. And I would suggest that when we think of voting our ethics, we should be thinking first and foremost about how do we preserve the dignity of individuals in this country. Examples come to my mind of this in history. I mentioned this example a couple of weeks ago. were with Betsy Ten Boom, Corrie Ten Boom's sister. And many of you know the story of how this family and these two women took in Jewish refugees, and they were Christians, and took them in as Jewish refugees and protected them from Hitler's government. After they were imprisoned, and Betsy died in prison, Corrie was released. Betsy had this vision that when she was released, she would start a home for former prisoners to basically usher them back into civilization, and also a camp for Germans to help them learn how to love again, and then to take the hope that, and the blessings that she had received from her time in prison and tell people about those blessings. Now, that is something that doesn't smell like it comes from the world. It smells like it comes from heaven. It has the aroma of the kingdom about it. That impulse, that heart impulse of going to the people who were the bad guys and the people who were the victims and helping both of them, so to speak. And then talking about prison as a place of learning, a place of growing, a place of spiritual awakening and deepening. That's not the way the world thinks. That's the way they thought. Yesterday, my wife and I went to see the story of Louis Zamperini. How many of you have seen the movie?
Read the book,
saw the movie. Louis Zamperini was an aviator who went down in the Pacific Ocean and spent 45 days on a raft. Was captured by the Japanese and then for several years tortured as a prisoner. And later, was after the war, was set free and had a rather tumultuous and tragic life in terms of his marriage, alcoholism, so forth and so on, but was powerfully converted at a Billy Graham crusade and turned his life around. The book did not make a big deal of that, nor did the movie. The movie dealt with more of his suffering, the first part of his life. He was to be the Grand Marshal of the Rose Parade this year. And he died just before the parade started, or shortly before this parade started. So he never had a chance to appear. But to the credit of CBS, one of the announcers, I think very appropriately, at the beginning of the parade, if you saw the parade, told of his personal relationship with Louis and how in the last 30 years of his life he was a shining light that was brighter than even the book or the movie portrayed in terms of his character. This was after his conversion. He loved people and reached out to people, even people who had basically hurt him or people that disagreed with him. And I think appropriately the attention was drawn to the role that Christ had played in his life in changing him and enabling him to have the kind of testimony that he did. He of course is not alone. There are other stories that come out of the Second World War that are just as dramatic. Some of you perhaps are aware of the fact that Jacob DeShazer, who was a bombardier in one of Jimmy Doolittle's raids on Japan, parachuted over enemy territory when his plane went down out of fuel, was captured by the Japanese government, and for 3 years was in solitary confinement and tortured, much the way Louis was. He was given a Bible while in prison, and he only had it for 3 weeks, but he read it in 3 weeks and became a Christian as a result of reading the Bible. When he got out, he came back to the States and became a missionary and went back to Japan. The city he bombed, he started a church in. And he had an opportunity to have an influence on a young man who was an aviator in the Japanese military. And this man was Mitsuo Fuchida, I believe, was his name. He became an evangelist with Jacob. And the two of them traveled in Japan and the U.S. and basically spoke together. Now, what makes this story most dramatic is the fact that Mitsuo was the commander of the raid on Pearl Harbor. He was the person who led that raid. And as a result of this man's testimony, he became a Christian, and they basically ministered together. These stories are powerful testimonies to the worth of individuals that's deeply embedded in the human soul and conscience. And the American founders understood this. And as Christians, we understand this. And we live in a country where, with respect to our involvement in the ethical decisions of this country, we should make that understanding present in our behavior, in our attitudes, starting with the way in which we treat people, starting with the way in which we handle our finances, starting with the way in which we understand the affairs of civic government, and extending that to the way we vote, the way we speak about issues, and what we elect, the kind of people we elect.
Jim?
Yes.
Beth and I personally met both of those men.
Really?
Our brother-in-law was a very close friend of DeShazer, and we also met the Japanese man when he was touring the USA here.
Wow, that's terrific.
Yeah, what a story.
It's a powerful story. Powerful story. There are other stories, too, that from World War II. There are a lot of them. Of course, that all happened long before I was born, but they were powerful stories. I think the second person in command under Hitler became a Christian after the war. He was Dönitz, Karl Dönitz, head of the German submarine force, was second in command. He was to take over if Hitler were killed. He became a Christian after the war, too. Very interesting story. Martin Luther King captures it nicely. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. And he modeled that. There have been a lot of people who have criticized Martin Luther King for a number of reasons, many of them legitimate. But one of the things that I think as Christians we should not ignore is the fact that Martin Luther King, in many respects, embodied the core of the ethics of the American idea and of the Christian idea. The dignity of human beings, and the power of love to conquer and heal. 1 Peter chapter 2, the Apostle Peter speaks about church and state in this way. Submit yourselves for the Lord's sake, to every human institution, whether to a king as the one in authority, or to governors as sent by him for the punishment of evildoers, for the praise of those who do right. For such is the will of God, that by doing right you may silence the ignorance of foolish men. Act as free men, and do not use your freedom as a covering for evil, but use it as bond slaves of God. Honor all people, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. And we say, Peter, yes, but. What happens when your government does not basically promote what is right and punish what is wrong? And you know what Peter says to that? He says, you do what's right. That's what he's saying here. He's saying, that is my concern, not yours. You do what is right. And I think when I read this, my first response is, yes, but. Peter, you've forgotten Nero was king. Peter, don't you remember? And I need to be reminded that my responsibility is to do right and not to contribute to the whining and the worry that so often characterizes the world. It is better to show our hope than to reinforce our hope on others. Submitting is a way of demonstrating our faith and hope in Christ, not in human institutions. And when we become deeply and passionately involved in political issues from a perspective that looks very much like the world's perspective, we are telling the world something about where our hope is. It's in chariots and horses, to use biblical terminology. It's in the institutions of our country. Now, again, don't misunderstand me. I'm not suggesting that the institutions don't play an important role. I'm saying that when you look at the teaching of the New Testament, Jesus' concern about the institutions is reflected almost entirely in terms of the ground up, inside out, the way in which people living under them, basically, and contributing to them, make the difference. Jesus was conspicuously lacking in a political agenda in terms of his values. That's deeply concerning to some of us, but it should be something that we learn from. The British tax on the colonies is a good example of where this might be applied. Should the American colonists pay the British tax on just about everything at the time just before the American Revolution? The Loyalists argued it is a tax that funds British protection of the colonists and the colonies from the French and the Indians. The Patriots argued that the tax comes without representation in Parliament. When I went to grammar school, it was the last part that I heard about. I didn't hear about the first part until I basically took the tour of the Citadel in Halifax, Canada. Then I heard the British perspective on the American revolt. Jesus' hypothetic counsel for Christians might look something like this. My interest is in God's kingdom, not man's. Pay the tax and be at peace. Show the world that your faith, hope, and love are in something bigger than political liberty. If you can gain freedom through peaceful means, do so. But not at the expense of your own soul and the lives of people made in my image. Now, the response that people are going to have is, but look at how good, how God has blessed America with goodness, and how much good America has done, being a blessing to the world. Are you saying the American Revolution was not God's will? Well, my response would be, the fact that God works all things together for good should not surprise us. But it does not mean that the ends always justify any means. And I would also add, the American legacy is at best mixed. We have an appetite for and an addiction to rebellion from all external authority, including God. As a matter of fact, for many of us, we refuse to join a church. There's just not a church that's pure enough for us. I mean, it's my relationship with God, and God is the way I define Him. He's made, to a large extent, in the image of my private theological system. That seems very American. Not really American, but it's a part of our culture. The fact is, we do not like authority, period. Where else can a country as powerful as ours make fun of our president, call him names, and really slander him, or any of our leaders? And we do that with a sense of pride in terms of our freedom. Where else do you have that kind of freedom? Yes?
Most places in the West.
That are influenced by the same culture, that's right. You won't find that in Great Britain in the same way that you found it here. Yes?
In Russia, they're quite able to curse our president.
Well, I remember before the wall came down, when there was a student exchange between the Soviet Union and American universities, there was open dialogue between Soviet students and American students, and the American students were fielding questions. One of the questions of the Soviet students was, "Why are you so critical of America?" And the response from the Soviet students is, "We're critical of America because you were critical of America." In other words, you recognize the same things we recognize in terms of what's wrong with America. And of course, the point is, you can't do that or couldn't do that in the Soviet Union at the time. Our pride is the shadow of our independence dimming the light of God's image shining through us. When we become independent, when it becomes about us, the image of God dims. And when that pride comes out, it basically buffers our sense of ethical wisdom. To the extent that we abuse our liberty, we indicate that we are not worthy of it. And we are proud of the fact that we can oftentimes abuse our liberty. That's part of our right and freedom. What I'm saying is this. When we think America is great, it's great in many ways. But we must never forget that America is a mixed bag. And the very things that have made us unique and great have also been our weakness. Okay, let's take another issue. Taxation of funding for abortions. Something that's a little closer to home for some of us. Should Christians' tax dollars go for Planned Parenthood? Yes, would be one argument. Pay the tax and protest abortion issues on other grounds. No, is another response. Don't let your tax dollars support positions that violate your conscience. If yes, we are discredited in the Christian community. If no, we are marginalized in the broader community. Either way, we are losing our influence. But I think we've got to ask ourselves this question. In Paul's day, Peter's day, under Nero, under Roman government, did the Roman tax support programs that were offensive to God's people? Probably not. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. I wrote you in my letter, Paul says, not to associate with immoral people. I did not at all mean with immoral people of the world, or with the covetous and the swindlers and the idolaters. For then you'd have to go out of the world. For what do I have to do with judging outsiders? You not judge those who are within the church, but those who are outside, God judges. Now with these words, Paul is saying something that is very important for us to understand. Christians are not to be in the world without being... We are to be in the world without being of it, of the world, or demanding that it conform to Christian moral standards. When we basically open our Bible and says that the Bible teaches against this or for this, when we try to make that law in our country for everyone, we then are taking away something of the genius of the founding fathers, which is teaching us basically we don't want to be ruled by the church. When that happens, it doesn't work well for the church or for the state. We've got to trust the individual. We have enough to do in disciplining ourselves in the church, let alone in the world. And what that means for many of us, we've got to lighten up a little bit in terms of what happens around us and recognize the best way in which we can influence a lot of that is by demonstrating an alternative as opposed to cursing and controlling the elements in our environment. Same-sex marriage might be an example. If homosexual conduct is to be tolerated, does that also apply to same-sex marriage? I think the scripture is quite clear in terms of the unnatural nature of homosexual behavior. But does that mean that we should have laws that forbid that kind of behavior? Or does it apply to marriage? Why are civil unions unacceptable as opposed to marriage? And that suggests the issue is not about tax benefits to those who are couples and gay, but more about the credibility of homosexuality. And I would argue that marriage is really a smokescreen for a much deeper, more profound issue, and that is, what happens to someone who is a homosexual in terms of their marginalization in society? Do they lose the image of God if they're gay? Do they become unworthy of care and love if they're gay? Now, of course, they up the stakes by saying, unless you parade or unless you endorse or unless you affirm my gay behavior, you don't love me or don't care for me. Christians have got to walk that line where basically we are able to express the teaching of Scripture concerning God's intention for man, but at the same time, deeply care and love and come alongside people who are gay and not push them under the bus. And I think so often what happens is, as Christians, we are pushing people under the bus whose sexual preferences we deem, perhaps rightfully so, as unnatural and unhealthy. How would changing views of marriage affect the general welfare of a family or society? If general welfare is the standard by which we make ethical decisions as citizens and rendering to Caesar, we've got to ask the more important question, how is this going to affect the understanding and the power, the role of family in our culture? And I'm going to argue when we get to it later in the series, that when it comes to the contribution to the general welfare of the future generations of this country, there's no greater contribution that we can make than to uphold what I'm going to call the traditional family. Father, mother, together in a loving relationship. There is nothing that can substitute for that. The government can't do it. The church can't do it. Two men and two women can't do that. That is something that uniquely, in God's design, creates healthy people and citizens. And that's something that is in the interest of the general welfare. If homosexual passion is a civil right, which is what activists, I think, parade a lot for, because it feels natural, what about other forms of sexual passions that feel natural? Does that mean a pedophile, because it feels natural, should basically have rights? Or someone who is promiscuous sexually? For people who are promiscuous habitually, it feels very natural to them. How about someone who is a polygamist? Then they feel very natural. Where do you draw the line in terms of what is natural? I think most people recognize, if they're outside the passions of the moment with respect to sexual orientation, would say there's something that just doesn't look right or seem right with respect to same-sex unions, so forth and so on. That's a different issue, except at this point, when we address that at the forefront, is this sense of what is in the general interest, the general welfare of the population, and the dignity of the individual, both those who are affected and those who are affecting. Again, Martin Luther King: morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. Judicial decrees may not change the heart, but they can restrain the heartless. And in that respect, laws are necessary. Advocates of abortion, gay marriage, and evolution as an origin, as a source of origins, tends to frame the debate so as to obscure, in many cases, the root issue. Abortion is framed as a choice issue when it is perhaps best understood as a civil rights issue, the rights of the unborn. Gay marriage is framed as a civil rights issue when it perhaps is really a respect issue in terms of a person's dignity. Origins is framed as a science issue when it's perhaps best a religious or philosophical issue. Evolution is about development, not origins. I'm thinking of ultimate origins now, not just the origin of human beings. But ultimate origins is something beyond science. All are arguably general welfare issues, because they speak to and about the worldview that promotes the general welfare. Now, these are all arguable things, debatable things. In this room, there would be a complete spectrum of views on many of these issues. I'm arguing this, that when we talk about them as citizens in terms of ethics, we should be talking about them in terms of what is in the interest of the general welfare. Loving relationships generally include generous amounts of flexibility, forbearance, and forgiveness. In marriage, in families, in work, in churches, in government as well. But the greatest and I think most powerful example and testimony to the dignity of man is the price paid for his soul. We are not worthy of our salvation. We all know that. But we are worth saving. And those that God loves enough to die for should be loved by us with his love. That's basically what it means to render to Caesar. Next week, we'll look at economic justice and power, which is Exhibit A in terms of the general welfare, I'm going to argue.
Okay.